Hey, everybody, this is Dominic D'Angelo of adfreeshows.com and wrestling.com, but I'm here today to do 20 years of TNA. This is the second episode that I'm doing. The first one was with Gail Kim, and now I'm happy to have with me here the originator of Aces and Eights and part of TNA as well, Mr. Eric Bischoff. Eric, thank you for joining me today.
Hey, it is my pleasure, Dominic. I love your work and love an opportunity to be on camera with you, man.
Well, thanks. No, it's always fun to do. And you're one of my favorite interviews I've done. This is my third one I think I've done with you, and we always have a good conversation. You had a great conversation with Bully Ray this past Monday. Mm-hmm. Talk about how you feel, how that all went. Bully has he's so opinionated, but he's very smart in his viewpoints and direct about it too. And he was on that episode with you and Conrad.
Yeah. You know, it's one of the things I love about Bully. You know, we've been pretty good friends for a long time. And I think one of the reasons why is what you see is what you get. You know, there's no ambiguity in any level of conversation with Bully Ray. You always know where you stand. You know where he stands. He has so much conviction in his way of doing things and his process and what he thinks gets over. And it obviously works, man. He's a talented dude, but I dig him because he's so straightforward.
Yeah, he doesn't pull any punches. And like like you said in that interview too, he wants to see good things happen in the business. And he likes talking about the good stuff. And there's been a lot of like negativity and bad stuff kind of going down lately with a lot of things. So, but yeah, I loved his perspective. And it really, going back and listening to that episode, really charged me up because, yeah, I was right in the thick of watching TNA and everything like that back with the Ace and A8s. Was he always the original plan to be the leader? Did you have the concept in mind? And then you were like, okay, these guys would fit these roles. Or how did that kind of come together for you ultimately, would you say?
Yeah, it wasn't either a chicken or an egg.
Yeah.
Meaning it wasn't like I had the story all laid out and then I had to cast it. Or that I looked around and went, wow, here's a group of guys. Let's figure out what to do with them. It wasn't either or, but it was a little bit of both. You know, it doesn't do any good to come up with ideas or try to come up with ideas that the people on your roster couldn't pull off, right? Or it wouldn't be a great fit. So the Aces and Eights idea kind of came about, as we talked about, as a result of the success of Sons of Anarchy. So it's like, okay, what if we do this? And wait a minute, we got these guys over here. Bully would be the best. Now, I asked Bully how he felt about it. You know, on the podcast, he touched on it, you know, a couple months before I actually tapped him, you know, to be the leader of the group.
Yeah.
A month and a half, maybe. So the idea was always in my head, but, you know, sometimes you don't know how talent's going to react to it. And sometimes come up with better ideas. But this is generally the idea going in.
That was it. Yeah. And, you know, it was right. You're right, too, because it was right in the thick of Sons of Anarchy. And like that was the hot show. FX had a lot of those good shows on that, like really engaging television. I love the Shakespearean dynamic that was in on Sons of Anarchy with like,
oh, very much so.
It's such a cool aspect of it all. And kind of to execute and implement it in the storyline. And your affinity for biking and like, you know, motorcycles and stuff like that, it just really did make perfect sense.
Well, you know what, and I don't want to spend all this time talking about just Aces and Eights, but
yeah,
one of the reasons that I liked that kind of a storyline, a biker club kind of derivative, if you will, is because, you know, especially Sons of Anarchy, and you mentioned the Shakespearean qualities to it, you know, Jax, the character, he was a flawed character, but you were cheering for him. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was an evil guy. He did evil shit.
Yeah.
You know, and he killed people. But usually they had it coming anyway.
Right, you
know?
Yeah.
This is such a bad thing.
No.
But the whole motorcycle culture has always been something that entertainment in this country has been fascinated with, really since after World War II, when World War II fighter pilots came over here and were a little bored and then decided, hey, let's all buy some motorcycles and go ride together. And that's where a lot of the original motorcycle clubs came from, was ex-military. And that subculture of flawed characters will always work in professional wrestling because everybody can relate to it.
Absolutely. And like, you know, people root in pro wrestling. Everybody's looking for the outlaws and that kind of vibe and identity, like Stone Cold epitomized that and everything. So going into that and factoring a faction like that, I think really meshed very well. And Marcus and I were talking, my brother, we're just talking about it off air about how like engaged we were by that storyline and how like, and me looking back at it too, that moment at TNA is really what got me kind of invested more so into wrestling moving forward, because I wanted to make more of it and learn more about it behind the scenes. So
it really was a great time in TNA. I mean, there was probably a lot of different points in TNA's existence, at least under the Carter family that I'm, you know, familiar with. Even during the time I was there, there were a number of points along the way for a couple of years where TNA could have made a slightly different decision or maybe a little bit more of a commitment. And it could have been a turning point. And not to just keep putting this story over, but, and this is all, you know, I'm paraphrasing Bully here from his perspective, but that storyline may have been one of the most well-developed storylines in terms of its consistency in its arc. And it wasn't perfect, don't get me wrong, but it had a structure to it and it kept people engaged and it grew. And as Bully pointed out in the podcast, you know, that was a live of our TV taping that we did that drew 7,000 people.
Yeah.
That's the biggest gate TNA ever drew in the US. So there was momentum, you know, it was building. And then, you know, before you know it, the rug gets pulled out and that's the end of it. But there, it was a very cool story. And it was a fun process.
That's what I was going to follow up with, too, is you mentioned it to Bully on the podcast was not being able to tour as much as you wanted to and like get that, because you're so right. And you even look at it from the perspective of NXT, how they're just situated in the Capitol Wrestling Center and then the Performance Center and stuff. And it, as great as the talent is and as like epic as some like angles and storylines and the personas are, it doesn't, you don't get that natural reaction just staying put, because things either get stale by the crowd there, or the dynamic is just off because it's such an intimate setting that doesn't create itself for the live crowd that wrestling really needs.
It's that, it's all of that. And, you know, I don't want to get too cosmic here, you know, but there's a certain energy, you know, when you're there, when you're in front of 5 or 6 or 7,000 people and the guys next to you are having fun and they're screaming and yelling, so hell with that, I'm going to do that too. And everybody, it's a party, you know, and that energy is kind of contagious because everybody wants to be in that mood. They're coming to that event to express their emotions and cheer and boo and whatever. That's what they're coming for. That's their expectation. And when you go out there with 3, 4, 5, 6, 10, 20,000 people or more, that energy not only affects what you see in the ring and the performances in the ring, and in some cases, even outside the ring, you know, backstage, because the energy's that high, but it also affects the viewer at home.
Absolutely.
And it's the difference between watching a show. I did shows in sound stages for a long time. I was one of the first ones that did them in a Hollywood soundstage. Technically, it looks good, but the energy's just not there. And it doesn't matter what you put in the ring. I used to tell this to Dixie all the time. I said, Dixie, if you could sign Undertaker, no, this is what, 8 years ago.
If
you could sign Undertaker and you can get him to descend from a helicopter through the roof of the venue, you know, and have him right in the center of the ring and wrestle in a TNA ring, it wouldn't matter.
No.
Because it just didn't have the energy, the credibility of that connection with the audience. And I don't, and it has nothing to do with the talent. The talent can work their guts out. It really doesn't even have much to do with the creative at that point, because you're disengaging the audience because of the lack of energy, and they're used to energy.
Absolutely. Would you consider that kind of the Achilles heel to the whole execution of your time in TNA, was that kind of just not being able to do that? If you boiled it all down, was that the number one reason, like would you say?
Yeah, well, the number one reason and the number two reason are interchangeable, but they're directly related in that is, yes, there's no way that that brand would ever grow to the extent that the network wanted it to, and even the investors wanted it to. There's no way it would grow in that very limited soundstage environment.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And had management the vision and the commitment, long-term commitment, to let that build and grow, it could have been hugely successful. TNA would still be here today in a much different
form. Broader sense of things and everything. As far as working, getting to work with your son and Garrett and stuff like that, that was the introduction to, for me and like a lot of fans to meet Garrett and kind of get, put him in that dynamic. You said on the podcast with Bully, you did not want him to really get into wrestling, and you kind of warned him about stuff like that and everything. Getting him involved into that dynamic with Hogan and those big stars, but also some of the younger talent too, that was in TNA as well. How do you think ultimately that that played to his benefit in like flourishing more so as a wrestler and a performer?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, Garrett is a much different personality than I am.
Mm-hmm.
Very much like his mother. Garrett, we used to call him Ferris Bueller. When he was like 4 years old, 5 years old, four, my wife and I, you know, Garrett and our daughter lived in North Minneapolis, right off 35W, which goes right through downtown Minneapolis. And it's an older city, you know, and very crowded and all kinds of people in that neighborhood. But even back then, you know, we could let Garrett walk up and down the street with his wagon and he'd go visit the neighbors. He'd walk 3-4 houses down and he'd go visit with, you know, there's an elderly couple. He called them, you know, Grandpa Boobah and Grandma Mooma or something.
Yeah.
They were a Swedish couple. They were like in their 80s. My wife would be like, oh, where's Garrett? Oh, he's down at Grandma Boobah's. So who's Grandma Boobah? I go down, knock on the door, and they go, oh, you must be Garrett's dad. Say, yeah, I'm Garrett. I've been Garrett's dad since Garrett was about 4 years old.
That's crazy to think of like that. So he was pretty, he's a socialite in a lot of ways, huh? He gets engaged with a lot of people.
He certainly wasn't TNA. Now, Garrett also had a little bit of an advantage. Regardless of how, you know, certain people may have felt about me, whether we were good friends or they were, you know, had their doubts about me, whatever, or anything in between. Garrett, you know, I brought him in as a referee.
Yeah.
Other than putting him in catering, there's not much, you know, that's an entry point, you know what I mean? It's right at the bottom. And he worked his way up, and he gained everybody's respect, the younger talent, the ones that would be most likely to be a little resentful. But Hulk Hogan has known my son since my son was 8 years old.
Right, right.
You know, yeah. I mean, we're family friends, for crying out loud. We've gone out on the boat, 4th of July, and hung out together. All that stuff, you know, same with Sting, you know, same with, you know, Kevin Nash. I mean, there was a lot of people in TNA that were in WCW when Garrett was hanging around the locker room as a 10, 12, 14 year old kid.
Right.
He had a lot of connective tissue going in, and the people that he didn't know, because he's got a big personality, a good personality, it didn't take long for him to bond with them as well.
How'd you feel? Did you get to watch his match with Wes? On Impact, was it last week or the week before?
Yeah, I did watch it. Yeah, my wife and I both watched it, for sure. I was very excited for him, you know, because I know he's having fun with it, you know, and that's the one thing. I didn't want Garrett to get into wrestling for a lot of reasons, you know, just like you wouldn't, you know, if your son came to you and said, okay, Dad, I think I want to be a rock and roll star.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you don't want to crush someone's dream, but you want to make sure they really understand what that really means in terms of where you start and where you may have a 1/10 of 1/100th of a percent chance of actually making a living at it. And that's how I felt with Garrett. But he's a smart kid. He did well. And it was a fun time.
It was. And like, as a viewer too, I thought he fit right in, like, honestly, from the perspective of, hey, it's a new talent. You want to get somebody over and kind of get them in the mix of that, and putting them in the rankings of like the aces and eights made plenty of sense, I think, too.
Yeah, no, it was fun. Like I said, now, you know, that he had his toe in the water, he got to work with Kurt Angle and AJ Styles and Hulk Hogan and Ric Flair and Sting. And I mean, come on.
Yeah.
who is it? Jeff Hardy. I mean, who is it going to brag about that? He got to do that. And now when he gets involved, he's just having fun doing it.
Right.
You know, just going out there for a blast. And that's
you get the balance of life there. You get the balance of life.
Yep.
So, okay. I wanted to get your thoughts. I'm sure you've addressed this before, but I wanted to get, kind of get your thoughts too, just in the name of TNA in general too, when it had it there. You know, I remember being watching it too and being like, why aren't they switching the name? Like, you know, was that a big bug for you at all? Or how did where did you kind of weigh
up? Drove me batshit crazy. it was so stupid and offensive. And not because, you know, I'm so afraid somebody would think I work for a company called Tits and Ass. I am not that guy. Yeah. You know what I mean? it's not that. It's just that I was offended because it was so childish and stupid. I was embarrassed to say, if somebody met me in an airport or just randomly somewhere and said, oh, what do you do for a living? The last thing I would ever say is I work for TNA.
Yeah.
You porn producer? What is that?
Is that another Coliseum video?
and I think what made it worse for me is because I know where the idea came from. And I know the 13-year-old prepubescent, frustrated, zit-faced little boy in a bathroom with a Playboy magazine. I know where that kid's humor is. And that's where the name of that show came from. It was childish humor. Like a 13-year-old would come up with.
Right. I was just like right out of college, I think, at that point. And I was like, this name is ridiculous. Come on, guys, change the name. I'm just waiting for it to happen.
I don't even know how uncreative and stupid you would have to be to think that that was a good idea. And there's some kind of cute little double entendre that will make people chuckle.
Yeah, right.
So and
it sets a table, a ceiling for you, because it's like, all right, TNA, are you gonna become a publicly traded company with that kind of name? Like, what's going on?
No, even the product itself, it didn't represent anything. Now, after the fact, they said, oh well, it's not tits and ass. What do we call it? Oh, we'll call it total
non-stop
action. It sounds like something you'd see on a Japanese T-shirt. Have you ever been to Japan and seen some of the crazy logos they have for things? They use English words and put them all together, but it doesn't mean a damn thing. But it's a badass looking logo.
Yeah.
When somebody came up and said, no, we'll call it TNA. That stands for total, what starts with an M? Nonstop.
You okay?
Action. Yeah.
There it is.
Nonstop action.
We'll roll with it. Let's roll with it. Okay. Did you have a name in mind if you could have changed it?
No. One of the first, I broached the subject when I first got into TNA. And I did it casually, not like, hey, I've got an idea. You guys got to change it. I didn't do that.
Yeah.
I learned to be more subtle.
Yeah.
At that point. But, you know, over a period of a couple conversations, over a couple weeks or months, I kept going, where did that name come from? Not in a critical way. Just tell me more. I want to learn about this company kind of thing. And along those lines of conversation from time to time, I would kind of just knock on the door and see if anybody would open it up a little bit to the idea of maybe changing that name.
Yeah.
But no, people actually thought that brand was valuable. They thought it was really valuable. It was an albatross.
It was. If you're not thinking like Major League Baseball, you're not thinking like National Football League or the National Basketball Association. You're not thinking like core names of like what you want as an organization. It's just.
No, you know, I like the idea of a. You know, and wrestling is obvious, you know, Raw. Well, what's more Raw than professional wrestling? SmackDown speaks for itself. Dynamite is a little bit of a rip. I mean, similar in a fashion to Nitro. Dynamite. Yeah. Wow, genius. But you know what? It's okay, because when you hear the name Dynamite, it's an explosion. It's energy, right?
Right.
It's loud. It's exciting. Well, hell, that's a hell of a good name for a show. All kidding aside. But I like those kind of names. And, you know, what does the name of your show, especially if it's an action show in a series, what does it represent? When people hear it, what's the first thing they think of?
Right. Yeah. You want to think. You want to think sports like feel, and you want to feel like, yeah, excitement and action going into it. It's just.
Yep.
And you don't get that. You don't get that with you get TNA. What I get with TNA is I feel like I'm at an independent show and there's some creepy dude wearing like a blazer over his stuff and selling video games.
He's coming to the show in a raincoat with a big popcorn.
Right. And you're like, stay away from that guy, okay? Families, hipsters, it doesn't matter. Keep away from him. All right. Well, I'll close it off with this. I want to,
close it off. Are you in a hurry or what?
Oh, no. I was just 20. We got to, I was 20 minutes was all. We could keep going. I actually wanted to get your thoughts, too, just on the execution of the Sarza in Impact Wrestling. Like the story, the anticipation. I thought you told it perfectly, too, with Aces and Eights and stuff like that. And you described it to, with Bully and everything like that. Certain aspects too? Was there another angle that you really embraced the Sarza aspect, or do you kind of go with that with everything that you do?
Yeah. When AJ, when we found out he was having an affair with Claire, Claire.
Yep.
And the whole storyline and saga with Dixie and all of that. I love that storyline.
Yeah,
I loved it. And I know wrestling fans hated it, right? It's kind of like in a category of its own in terms of just vile rejection and hatred by wrestling fans. But I loved it. And I think, and Bruce Pritchard will actually attest to this.
Yeah.
And he would know. But one of the reasons that WWE became interested in AJ Styles was because of that storyline.
Really?
AJ Styles ended up on WWE's radar as a result of that storyline.
No way.
Initially. Now, it took a while, right?
For things to happen. Yeah.
AJ was out of contract, obviously. But that's when they went, ooh, who's that kid? And Bruce would be better to tell that story. But one of the things that I'm proud of is because AJ hated that story. It was so opposite of who he was as a human being, because AJ is a very, very, he's got a lot of integrity as a man, as a husband, as a father.
Very spiritual too, he's a very spiritual guy.
Very spiritual guy. And now I'm asking him to do something that is just so antithetical to who he is. And on top of that, you know, AJ's always seen him as he should, is like that athletic baby face, you know, clean, you know, close cut, you know, you look like he could walk, you know, out of a military, you know, platoon, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So straight. And now I'm asking him to be basically a sleazebag.
Right.
And he didn't want to do it. And I don't blame him. But he did it. And he tried. And the process of trying to really make that storyline work forced AJ to go outside of his comfort zone as a performer. He had to go out there and do something that was so against his grain, but try to figure out how to do it and go out there and deliver it. And he did a great job.
Yeah, he did. He very
as a performer, he did a phenomenal job. But to go through the process of, oh, I hate this idea. This isn't me. This isn't my character. This isn't who I am, to, okay, I'm going to try to do this. That's tough. And he did it. And I think by doing so, I think it helped him learn how to become a bigger, better character down the road, because he'd had that experience.
No, and you see all the angles that he took place in after the fact of that, too, whether it's in WWE or when he was with Bullet Club with New Japan and stuff like that. And it's like, there's something, too, that's called like exposure therapy. Like, if you're, you know, I have OCD. So like, if I want to do something that gives me anxiety or stress, and go, if I have to go and do it, that is exposure therapy, to go and do something against that, what you don't want to do, and then doing it, and if you keep doing it, you become more comfortable with it, and then I think it just executes like that. And I think that can really apply to wrestling, and what AJ did with that angle, I'm sure it helped him to kind of create a foundation of like, hey, I'm capable. If I could do that, I could do this too.
You know? Yeah, it's just another form of experience, and you gain confidence. And the next time you're faced with an uncomfortable character, or maybe even if it's not uncomfortable, you just can't figure that character out.
Right.
you can kind of go back to, okay, well, I couldn't figure that other one out. How did I do that? You know, you just, you have the and the confidence to do it. And I think that's probably true with any form of performance art. I'm guessing it's true with music. You become a better musician by pushing your envelope and forcing yourself to do things and learn things and try things that you might be uncomfortable with. Acting, I'm sure it's the same way. Oh, so works for wrestling too.
Absolutely applies. Tell me about, like, overall, just your experience with Dixie Carter and everything. You know, I think there's a lot of misconceptions with her, but there's also, like, you hear about how sweet she is and how nice she is to people backstage and thoughtful and considerate in a lot of ways. Talk about just the relationship overall during your time there and your relationship now, if you have one still with.
You know, I haven't talked to Dixie or traded a text with Dixie in a long time, but I have a lot of affection for Dixie. I really like her as a person. I like her husband, Serge. He's a good guy. Fun as hell to be around. I mean, they're fun. They're good people. And they're just like you and your brother. As I told you off camera, you guys just bring a certain energy, you know? And Dixie is like that. She's just a nice, positive person. And Serge the same way. My frustration, I've never not liked Dusty or Dixie. I've always thought a lot of her once I got to know her. But I was frustrated with her.
Sure. You know? And yeah.
Part of that, in fairness to her, is because I didn't fully understand the really complex dynamic between her and her parents.
Mm-hmm.
And her family, who were the investors. It was a very, very complicated, almost dysfunctional relationship at times when it came to business.
Yeah.
I didn't understand that. So I was like, why don't you just make a decision?
Come on,
I dare you to make a decision. Well, the truth is, she probably couldn't.
Yeah.
But I didn't know that. So,
yeah.
There's that.
It was like, her time there, like, there was stuff too as a viewer, it was like head scratching, and you'd just be like, why is this stuff not going on? And you can kind of see too from an outside element, okay, maybe she seems a little bit out of her element and things like that, and that maybe this is not what is, I don't know, conducive or, you know, beneficial to the wrestling product in general.
Are you talking about her being on camera or what?
No, more so just from maybe like a decision making standpoint, things like that, where it would come into play,
you know. And again, I have empathy, you know, for people in that position. It's very easy to be critical. It's very, very easy to be critical. But, you know, Dixie was learning on the job. She didn't know fuck all about wrestling before she woke up one day and decided to buy a wrestling company. And even then, you know, you don't learn the business by owning one. You learn the business from kind of learning it from the ground up. You know, if you're going to build a house, you have to build a house from the ground up. Don't start at the roof because you can afford it.
You
got to kind of, and you learn along the way, no matter how smart someone is or how experienced they may be at other things. Until you're there and experiencing those weird dynamics between talent and audience and networks and competing ideas and the politics that inevitably become, you know, ugly, MJF or whatever.
Right.
You know, it's until someone's in that position, they don't really know what they're getting into. So I have, because, and I did it. I've been there, done that. So it's easy. It's a little easier for me to look at some of those decisions and just go, well, she's learning on the job.
This is like their first experience kind of thing too. Yep. Very much to that. Okay. So if you had to do like any mulligan in TNA, say you got like one more shot to like give something another go around, what would you do if there was something specific that stands out or anything in general, like an over encompassing thing?
No, I can't think of one, buddy, because I was able to pretty much try anything I wanted to try.
You mentioned that. Yeah, you mentioned that in the interview too with Bully.
So it wasn't like, oh man, I want to do this one idea. Dixie wouldn't let me, or somebody else wouldn't let me, or the network wouldn't let me. It was none of that. The network, you know, I had a great relationship through Dixie, but I had a great relationship with Kevin Kay and Scott Fishman and Ryan Diamond and some of the, you know, folks at Spike TV, now Paramount. It was easy, brother. It was easy. So I've got no do-overs.
Hey, that's great. Because you know what? From that, like I said, that run stood out to me to like get me into the business more so and get more invested in knowing the behind the scenes kind of things other than just what I'm seeing on television and stuff like that. So, no, yeah. I think it was a great time for TNA. I would have, I remember just being all about like, hey, going to the live shows and kind of rooting and seeing it go up against WWE. I thought was a very cool experience as a fan. So, yeah, it was great.
Cool.
Yeah. Thank you so much for taking the time to do this.
Hey, my pleasure. I'll do anything for you guys. You just, you got my number. You know how
to find me. For sure. All right. Hey, gang, we'll see you next time here when we do 20 years or 30 years or whatever it's going to be. We'll figure something out. But thanks for tuning in. All right, Eric. Cool.
Thanks, man. Talk to you later.
It's always great to talk to you. All right.